This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town. Your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
Do you use Elon Musk's Starlink? If you're in regional Victoria, then the answer is probably yes. Well, one of his satellites, Starlink 5103 to be exact, came crashing down and put on quite the light show this morning. And it turns out he's not coming to pick it up. And satellites falling from space, well, it's starting to be a problem.
Over the past few years, SpaceX has been launching thousands of these internet satellites into low Earth orbit, and they don't actually last particularly long. This particular satellite was only launched in 2022, and so after a few years of use, they come down. And because he's been launching many thousands of these satellites each year, these satellites are starting to come down almost daily across the globe.
So that's Associate Professor Michael Brown speaking with Bob and Charnel on our breakfast program this morning. So satellites are coming down daily somewhere around the world. So how big a problem is this? Does that matter? And when we think about pollution, we think about the earth, we think about the sea. But are we also polluting our outer space? 1-300-222-774. And also this hour at around 11:30, you'll meet a woman, a former airline captain, who was told by her careers counsellor that she couldn't become a pilot because one day she'll get her period. So how far have we or haven't we come when it comes to getting women into aviation?
ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
But first, Writers Victoria has lost its funding. That now makes Victoria the only state without a state government peak organisation for writers. So does that matter? I mean, does this cut impact not just writers and emerging writers, but does it impact you and I, people who love to read? Toni Jordan is the author of 8 books. Her novel Addition has been turned into a film, which is in cinemas now. She's a Miles Franklin author. Toni, a warm welcome to The Conversation Hour and congratulations on your film now being made, your book now being made into a film.
Thank you so much, Rochelle.
How exciting to go to the cinema and to watch your work, but that's probably a story for another day.
But it's quite unbelievable, yes.
It really is, but it is connected to what we're talking about because this, I guess, is the evolution of your work and of your story and of your debut novel continuing to thrive and to take on another form. And yes, when we think about funding, when we think about Writers Victoria, how important is it? So what does it do? For most of us, we don't really know a lot about it. We don't rely on it. So what does it do?
Well, it really teaches people how to write, teaches writers how to write and how to get published, and also supports them at all stages of their career, when they're unpublished and when they're published. As an example, I did a course at Writers Victoria in 2010 called Page to Screen, and now all these years later, we can sit in the cinema and watch the film of Addition, which of course brings enormous financial benefits to Victoria. Mm. It was filmed here and really is a development of our wonderful film industry, which is so well supported. But if we're not supporting the source of these stories, I don't know where the films of the future, Victorian films of the future, are going to come from.
So without government funding, will it survive? Does it rely purely on government funding?
It has a strong membership base, and it charges, Writers Victoria charges for workshops and seminars and manuscript assessments. But the funding from the Victorian state government
provided the operating costs. So things like rent and staff, which was so important to us. And as Melbourne is a UNESCO International World City of Literature, it's a very big sort of slap in the face for our creative communities.
Were you given any warning? Were you told why the government pulled the funding? Because quite often funding for groups, unless you're involved in it somehow, it kind of just slips through the net and people don't know about it.
Well, already it was quite a modest sum of money compared to some of the other State Writers' Centre. I think the Queensland State Writers' Centre gets maybe five times more than Writers Victoria did, because we are such a strong organisation with so many members and workshops and things that are very well attended. All we just needed was a little bit of money just to kind of keep things running.
What's the reaction been to this, Tony?
Everyone is kind of shocked, because it's such an important part of the literary ecosystem. And the whole point of supporting the arts at a state government level should be to make sure we get more Victorian stories published, and Victorians from all walks of life and Melbournians from all walks of life have a chance to see their stories come to life.
You're listening to Tony Jordan, author of 8 books. Her novel Addition has just been turned into a feature film, which is in cinemas as we speak. We're talking about Writers Victoria and the fact that the state government has pulled their funding from Writers Victoria. We like to really hang our hat on how creative we are as a state, whether it be music or the arts or writers. But when it comes to funding, when it comes to ensuring that these small businesses, these independent writers have a future, we're not so great at that, Tony, I find. And if we chip away at all of these groups, at all of these funding organisations, at all of the foundations of what we create, it will start to, it's a house of cards, it will start to fall away.
Absolutely right, Rochelle. I kind of think of it like the ocean. Like, we're very proud of the big fish and we support our big fish very well, but the big fish have to grow from being little fish. And if we're not supporting the nursery of where writers come from, then we're going to run out of big fish.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what Amal was saying from Amal and the Sniffers about, yeah, it's great to have these big accolades, but actually it's the small pubs that need our support. It's the exact same analogy. So what happens from here?
Well, there is an online petition that anyone can sign to try and get the government to relook at this decision. Closing the doors will be a very sad thing for a state that prides itself on being a centre for the arts and a hub for publishing in Australia.
To be an emerging writer, you know, as you said, you have to start somewhere, but to be a writer, I could imagine you, gosh, you're doing it on the smell of an oily rag, even if you're lucky, really.
It's so hard, I can't tell you. So, Writers Victoria was where I met my publisher, the person who bought my first manuscript, my first novel. They have a program called, you know, Meet the Publisher, where you can go and ask questions. And the publishing industry is a very big and kind of overwhelming business. And everybody who interacts with it, all individual writers, are sole traders, are just people at home or, you know, in libraries or in cafes typing on their laptops. And we really need someone to guide us through this process of interacting with businesses.
Given, and I guess just finally, given too, there's been such a big spotlight on writers' festivals, you know, big names cancelling, festivals cancelling, and actually just looking at how writers' festivals have merged and changed and really sort of just become really spaces for big ideas and big writers. And I was starting to wonder, where do the emerging writers fit into this? Where do the small bookshops fit into the future of writers' festivals now? So you've got that as one issue. What I've gathering from this is that Writers Victoria, you don't have to be a big name yet. You don't need a lot of money. You don't need a parent to already have something published, that you could sign up for a seminar, you could sign up for a course, and you could get a break. Is that going to be lost?
I think it's very much in danger of being lost. And that's something that is so great about our our writers and our publishing system here is that anyone can tell their story. Everyone has a story. And if you put in a lot of work, you've got a good chance of seeing other people engage with it. That's kind of the ultimate for us.
Well, keep us up to date, Tony, with what happens and, you know, how those signatures go. There's a little message here for you from Annie, and it says, I saw Tony speak after a screening of Audition at the Sun Theatre, which was fantastic. You are so down to earth. You are super positive and just amazingly creative. What a delightful human. So that's a little message for you from Annie.
That's gorgeous. Thank you, Rochelle.
Tony, thank you. Keep us up to date with what happens.
I will.
Tony Jordan, author of 8 books, her debut novel, Audition. You might have seen it in cinemas. So have you used Writers Victoria?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
This text, hang on, isn't Melbourne a UNESCO City of Literature? Yes, it is. That's what makes the cut of this funding so interesting. But if you were listening to Bob and Charnel this morning, over the course of their entire program, they discovered what initially people thought was a meteor in the sky. It turns out it wasn't. It was a piece of satellite. It was a piece of Starlink falling to the ground. But this is Associate Professor Michael Brown speaking with Bob and Charnel. And I swear, with everything that he said, it was just one thing after another where I was like, wait, hang on, what's going on up there?
Over the past few years, SpaceX has been launching thousands of these internet satellites into low Earth orbit, and they don't actually last particularly long. This particular satellite was only launched in 2022, and so after a few years of use, they come down. And because he's been launching many thousands of these satellites each year, these satellites are starting to come down almost daily across the globe. So they're going to become more and more common. No, all this space junk is being dumped in the upper atmosphere, and that might have consequences that haven't really been properly thought through yet. Interesting and not necessarily good stuff happening in space right now.
Fred Watson is an astronomer at large. Fred, seriously, with everything that Michael Brown said this morning, it was just like one bombshell after another. How polluted is our space?
It is polluted. It's still survivable in the sense that spacecraft don't often knock into one another, although that's not for want of trying. The SpaceX satellites that Michael was just talking about there, they've got active control so that they actually move around to dodge other spacecraft. And I was just reading this morning that they've actually, in the total history of Starlink, which goes back to 2019, they've made 146,000, I think was the number, moves to avoid hitting another spacecraft. So you're absolutely right. It's really polluted up there. And, you know, you were talking about bombshells there. There's several more on the way.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so if we make the comparison with Earth, if I wanted to put up a sign, if I wanted to put up a satellite somewhere out on the street, even in my yard to a certain degree, I would need permission. I might even have to pay in order to do that. If we are talking about thousands of satellites being launched into space, whether it be Elon Musk or another internet provider, do you rent that space? Like, do you pay for that space?
Yes, they do. And there is, there's a regulatory process that is very much the same as if you wanted to put a sign in your backyard. It's a bit more than a development application. So the process basically starts with a body called the International Telecommunications Union, and you have to file your intention to launch a spacecraft with the ITU, and they will allocate actually the communications frequencies. That's why the telecommunication word comes in there. But they are the only international body that looks at the entirety of orbital space.
So
but
at
once
some
you've
point,
done that,
yeah.
Sorry, forgive me. Once you've done that, then you've got to go through your own national bodies, like in America, Federal Communications Commission, yeah. NASA, all of those sorts of things.
So is there a cap? Like at some point, do they say, I'm sorry, Mr. Musk, you've had your quota?
That is a question that was asked at a meeting I was at a couple of years ago. A representative of the International Telecommunications Union was asked, what is the limit? And what they said was, we are only limited by the laws of physics. And what that's telling you is that there basically isn't a cap. You can put as much up there as you want, as long as you're not hitting your next door neighbour.
There's another bombshell for the day. I never thought I would learn so much about satellites in space in one day, and yet here I am. This is a very good question. This is from Judith. Fred Watson, astronomer at large, is with you. It says, Rochelle, I was wondering what would happen if the space junk landed on someone's home or property causing damage or a fire. With all the bushfires already, it would be easy to imagine that a piece of burning satellite could cause extreme damage. Who would be responsible for that? And Raf and I were laughing around the idea of, do we need to start walking around in helmets? But the idea that it could cause some damage on Earth...
Yes, absolutely. So, there's a lot of regulation surrounding that as well. So if you get hit on the head by a satellite, it is the nation which was the agency that launched that satellite that is responsible. And that's still true even in an era where it's mostly private companies that are launching them. It is still the country that they sought their authority from, their approval from, that is responsible for the spacecraft whilst it's in orbit, and also if it comes back to hit you on the ground. I might just add to this, though, Rochelle. Very few of them do. Most spacecraft, like the Starlink spacecraft that people saw this morning, they burn up in the upper atmosphere. Mm. So the debris does not reach the ground unless it's a very large spacecraft, and usually they are in a kind of controlled re-entry. There is a place in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, which is the point furthest away from land of any ocean on the Earth, and that's where they aim the satellites to destroy them if they are likely to survive their passage through the atmosphere. So it's not likely. Nobody's ever been hit on the head. A few people have had things come through their roof.
Yes. We don't need to wear our stack hats around just yet. But one would think if Elon Musk alone is sending up thousands, and he's not the only one that's doing this, he's the main player, but at least capping the amount of junk, the amount of satellites in space, is that a concern to astronomers like yourself? When we heard from Michael Brown earlier, associate professor and astronomer himself, I mean, he sounded worried about the level of pollution and the future of what's happening up there.
Indeed it is. So astronomers were kind of the first to raise the alarm when the first of these satellite constellations was launched, as I said, back in May 2019. And a huge amount of work has gone into quantifying what the problems are likely to be. It's not just astronomers using visible light telescopes that see their satellites leaving a line across the images that they're taking in space, and that's happening a lot. It's also the radio astronomers who have got equipment that can pick up a mobile phone on Mars, and suddenly you've got this thing going over your head which is broadcasting on frequencies.
Hang on, Starling, you can pick up a mobile phone on Mars?
Yeah, some of the radio telescopes we have on Earth can do that.
And yet we've got people in regional Victoria that have to walk to the top of the hill to get connection.
Well, you should go to Mars. It's probably going to be better served in the end.
That's true. You're closer, right?
I've lived in regional New South Wales, and I couldn't even walk to the top of the hill. There was nowhere I could get a signal. So I know all about that. But look, the issue, I think, and this is probably another bombshell, Rochelle.
I'm ready.
Elon has just filed with the Federal Communications Commission in the USA. He did this week. He's filed an application to launch 1 million satellites in a new venture, which is not communications. It's orbiting data centers. You put your data centers into orbit rather than having them on Earth. And that scares astronomers to death.
It should scare everyone to death. So how would... Oh, my goodness, I am so out of my depth here. But we know that data centres are a huge issue here for the amount of heat they cause, where we place them, how we position them, the amount of them that we're going to need. Is he going to be able to do that? Is someone going to say, oh, yeah, okay, we're a bit confused and out of space here, so you might as well take it up there?
My guess is it won't get past the International Telecommunications Union. Although, having said that, there is a filing that's been it's actually been active since 2020 for 300,000 satellites, which was a filing that was entered by the Rwandan government. Work that one out, Michelle. I think they've launched one CubeSat since then. So these filings are almost like, you know, putting your foot in the door. It's like staking your claim without the inevitable consequence that these spacecraft will be launched. So the view of the industry, I think, is that, yeah, a million spacecraft from SpaceX, from Elon Musk, let's see what happens. The odds are that it probably will never be approved.
Let's hope so. And this is interesting. Craig in Fitzroy North sent this message, because when you talk about the satellites being pointed towards a certain area of the ocean and that's where they crash, you know, it says, the ocean is not our infinite dumping ground. David Attenborough's docos show the damage that we're doing to our ocean life, and the idea of just seeing it, well, that's somewhere where it can be dumped because it doesn't matter. Is that, I guess, just finally, Fred, that's an issue, right? Where it's like, okay, well, it doesn't matter. It's just going to be dumped out in the middle of the ocean. That doesn't impact anyone. We know that's not the case.
Absolutely. I entirely agree with Craig. Let me just add one other thing, though. It's the upper atmosphere itself that's suffering as well, because most satellites just burn up in the atmosphere. And we now know that that is putting aluminium oxide into the upper atmosphere at levels that we've never seen before. So there's a few things going on that we really have to take notice of.
Wow. Extreme learning for me today. Fred, thank you. Thank you so much. Fred Watson, astronomer at large. I find the idea that we're putting hundreds of satellites that eventually fail instead of just laying down terrestrial cables for internet is just crazy. That's from Mohammed in Altona. We've also been talking about the state government cutting their funding to Writers Victoria and who that will impact and how it will impact not just writers and emerging writers, but all of us, readers, bookshop owners. Kathy's in Bacchus Marsh. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
What did you want to say?
Well, I've been a member of Moorabool Writers Craft for the group's been going for about 10 years. Mm-hmm. And Writers Victoria has been a critical contact point for us to recommend writers, you know, published writers who can do workshops for the group. Mm-hmm. And they've also, over the years, given us a couple of small grants to fund those workshops. And Moorabool Writers Craft started off as a really small group of writers and poets. And we've gone on, we now run weekly workshops for children who want to write as well as adults.
Yeah.
And also two members of the group launched the Peter Carey Short Story Award.
Oh, wow.
Which is now in its 10th year.
Gosh, it's interesting. It really shows, Kathy, doesn't it, that a funding cut, what looks like to be this top line, you know, Melbourne-based one organisation, that's not the case. It trickles down, it snowballs down into smaller writing groups, into little regional communities, that it filters its way out into the community, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, it certainly supported us in Bacchus Marsh and Balan.
So what will you do then if you don't get funding from something like Writers Victoria?
Well, I think we haven't applied for funding for a couple of years now because we mainly fund our workshops through people who are attending them paying, but we rely on Writers Victoria to be a central point where we can look at the people who are presenting workshops and look for their recommendations about who can run it. I just think that it's such a small amount of money, $100,000.
Yeah, and the impact that it has, that's right, for generations often to come. Kathy, thank you. I wish you and your group all the best. This is a message from Chris, and we're talking about just the amount of stuff that's sent up to space and the amount of space junk and space pollution that we're not just creating now, that we will potentially continue to create in the future. And do we even really know what we're doing and what the long-term impact will be? Chris says, I went to a presentation on light pollution, and there is a real impact on satellites impacting Indigenous culture, navigation and storytelling as the sky is just too polluted. It was so interesting, and it's horrifying, the lack of regulation. Chris, thank you. There's a text here that says, I was told by a nursing supervisor in the early 70s at a hospital is that what makes you think you have a right to go into nursing when you have two children? We've come a long way. So have we? And if a young woman went to a careers counsellor now and said, I want to become a pilot, I want to work in aviation, how much have things changed? In just a tick, you're going to learn about a new program where aviation specialists will work alongside teachers to try and get more people, both boys and girls, into STEM and into aviation. But Michelle Huntington, a former airline captain, Michelle, when you went to your careers counsellor and said, I want to be a pilot, what kind of reaction did you get?
Hi, Rochelle. I was actually shocked because I'd had this dream to become a pilot since I was seven, and my parents and everyone knew about it, supported me. So when I went into her office and she asked me what I wanted to be and I said pilot, she almost like laughed with pity about how I could be so naive. And she told me, like you just mentioned, that, yeah, I'd have to wear a tampon every time I flew. And it really wasn't a career for ladies. So
and
she
a woman,
told me to do something else.
She, a woman told you this?
Yes. So she obviously didn't know about Deborah Laurie and a few of the other women who had, gone on and forged a way for women in aviation. But unfortunately, she was responsible for, moulding young adults' minds for what they were going to do.
So you did end up becoming an airline captain, but did she have an influence on you? Like, was this something where you went, oh, right, okay, so I'm a woman, I'll bleed, I can't be a pilot?
Well, I'm giving away my age. I was, I grew up in the 70s and this was late 80s, which doesn't seem that long ago.
No, me either.
But I was pretty compliant. Like wow. I grew up with see and don't be heard sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so I just went along with what she said, no resistance. And I'd been good at art and colouring in and things. And she suggested I take that up as a career, which I then went to uni and did.
Wow. So they had a lot of influence.
They did. Yeah. Adults did in my world.
And school did. That's the thing, right?
Yeah,
so in just a moment, we're going to talk about a new program where we've got the CSIRO and aviation specialists actually going out into schools so that people don't get that type of advice. So then you did end up becoming a pilot, Michelle. So what happened? Did you meet someone else that, was a little more educated in the area?
Well, I actually ended up out in northwest New South Wales in Tamworth and joined an Oztag, a mixed Oztag team, and it was part of the British Aerospace Flight Training Academy. And there was a woman on the team, the only other woman, and she was training to become a pilot. She was about my age. I was now in my mid-20s. And, I silly said the thing about, oh, what do you do about the tampons? She thought I was a bit silly.
Yes.
she said, look, it's easy. You just pay the money, honestly. You just turn up and pass your tests. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to do it now.
Wow. So the role of teachers' careers counsellors, they're not to be overlooked. And, there's also this little stereotype, we think when someone is asked at a very young age, and you said, you were seven, oh, what do you want to be when you grow up? And if the answer is pilot, or astronaut, that it's just a bit of a joke, that you just laugh and you go, yeah, okay, well, you'll grow out of that one day. I mean, how seriously should we be nurturing these ideas?
Well, look, I've got teenagers and they're going through, what picking subjects for what they're meant to be doing when they grow up. And we've said to them, don't stress too much. Just go with what you enjoy. And if you want to become, my daughter wants to become an orthodontist, and she's actually had a careers advisor last year say, maybe you should choose something else. It's like, no, if you want to do that, you'll find a way. So it's always the, and that's how my parents encouraged my sister and I. We support you. You will find a way. We weren't a wealthy family. They weren't going to pay for any of my training or anything, but they knew that they'd be there to support us and we would find a way. And we did.
Gosh, things have changed. There's a text here from Lou. So, I mean, we've heard from nurses. We're talking aviation now, but Lou says, I was told by my then police officer father that being a policewoman was not a good career choice due to the lack of job equality and strong discrimination. That was in the 80s. Years later, we had a female police commissioner. I love my life, but I often wonder, what if? And that's from Lou. I do wonder, Michelle, how far have we come, do you think?
Look, I think because a lot of now careers advisors and people of influence are in schools, and like this program with CSIRO, people, like, we've been through that. So now I think we have more empathy and understanding on the influence that we do have, and we are encouraging. So this is a good thing.
And was it a great job? Like, did you love it?
I did. I loved it. And it, look, even going in later in life to aviation, I had all the skills from my past to take in with me, and a few wrinkles, you know, the passengers think that I've got more experience than maybe I might have had, so it didn't hurt.
I always wonder, you know, how great it would be. I know there's a lot of very, very, very important and skilled things you do, but when you say this is your captain speaking, it's like you'd be doing a little told you so to that careers teacher that told you, careers counselor that told you shouldn't do it.
Oh, absolutely. And we do put on different voices when we do our PA voice.
Do you? Great. I thought it'd be a fun little part of it. Any advice you give to someone listening now who's told that, you know, maybe you shouldn't do this?
Yeah, look, it's in aviation especially, it is an amazing career, and just no matter what part of it. So even if you're not a pilot, if you're in engineering, ramp, operations, it's such a great community, and you do get perks with it. You get to see Australia, the world, the community, you get to meet people, and it is, it's a little club. Once you're in aviation, it gets in your blood and you can't get away from it.
I love it. Michelle, thank you. It's always great to speak with you.
Thanks, Michelle. Bye.
Michelle Huntington, a former airline captain. I mean, that idea of when a young student says they want to be a pilot or they want to be an astronaut, you know, we need to take that seriously, potentially, that maybe they do want to do that and that they're not going to grow out of it. And how important is your careers counsellor? And how much have careers counsellors changed in terms of looking at how endless the possibilities are? Have we progressed? And do you even have a careers counsellor at your school? 1300 222 774. Annie Daly is the Chief Executive of Aviation Aerospace Australia and is a part of this new program heading into schools alongside with CSIRO and many aviation experts and in their field. Annie, the idea that Michelle was told she can't become a pilot, is this the reason why we need to get into school so that we get in whilst they're early and their dreams are still alive and fresh?
Oh, absolutely. And you have to be able to see and engage to really appreciate and understand, which is why our new program, Aviator in Schools, is very much about putting real-life people working across the huge sectors that aviation and aerospace and space offers, and really showcase to kids and to counsellors what a career looks like and how different they are, and how, if you know, if you find something difficult and challenging in this area, you can still work in this industry with those other skills, whether you're an engineer, a lawyer, a problem solver, an accountant. This is wonderful to get real people talking to kids.
The fight that we have for women, for people from different backgrounds, whether it be socioeconomics, whether it be culture, to get into STEM. It just seems like this endless fight. And I just wonder why that is. The numbers are always low. Are we seriously making any progress?
I would love to say that we are.
I
would say that the progress is incremental, and you can see over long periods that, you know, the dial does change, but it doesn't. It needs that, what I call the oomph drive, the revs, and it's just not there yet. And this is why, you know, sustained effort working, you know, we partnered with CSIRO, Australia's National Science Agency, because they are getting thousands of people into schools to really talk up STEM and to showcase what it really looks like. Break down those myths, particularly where school kids have parents that are not in this industry. But the numbers aren't, they're not good. You know, less than 6% of Australia's, you know, important people in air traffic control, piloting, aircraft maintenance, less than 6% are women. And this is a trajectory that, you know, is only changing by a few percent every year. So we need to make a big change, and we're part of trying to make that inspirational change.
And the importance of a careers counsellor, there's one here. I was in high school in the 1980s. The careers counsellor had a state-of-the-art computer program to give advice. I answered the 20 questions, which included, do you like the outdoors? I said yes. He advised me to be a road pothole repairer. Yet I've gone on to be an anaesthetist for the last 20 years. And another that says, I've never heard of a good experience from a careers counsellor. I was told what I wanted to do was unachievable. The same thing was told to my brothers. I've been making sure that my daughter knows that whatever they say is rubbish and they can do whatever they want to do. The work that you're doing, it's important to work alongside the careers counsellors and the teachers, because maybe they do think it's unachievable for that individual.
You know, I've always said that you have to be part of the change. If you want to see change, you have to be part of it, and you have to be willing to walk into schools. My heart goes out because teachers and counsellors now are like so stretched with, you know, the number of careers out there ever increasing and changing. But the reality is, you know, this kind of program makes it really simple and really easy. It makes it easy for the teachers, and it makes it easy for the STEM professional going into the schools. I mean, CSIRO works hand in hand with schools, with professionals to make sure that bridge is really, really strong and tight. You know, it's mentoring, it's careers talks, it's classroom presentations, it's hands-on activities, it's site visits, it's all of these things that when combined together make a difference. So my call to action is to tell people that if you're frustrated, it doesn't take much to just ping a teacher, ping a parent and tell them, apply for this.
Yeah.
It is short, it is easy, it is simple, and you can go in and you can be part of the change. And then you've got that wonderful feeling of going, I have made a small difference, because, you know, once an educator goes into there, once a professional goes and talks, it's so hard to not be inspired.
So how can people apply?
Very, very simple. It's a very easy expression of interest. You can Google, you know, CSIRO STEM professionals in schools or aviator in school programs. You will find us. We come up number one and two on the Googles, on the searches. It's simple. It takes 2 minutes to do an expression of interest, and then CSIRO and Aviation Aerospace Australia, we kick into gear to make the process.
Love
really,
it.
Really, really simple.
Yeah, great. And that's really good for even regional schools. Are you bound by
absolutely.
Geography in any way?
No.
Great.
Because there's a STEM professional everywhere. And
great.
Even the regional areas, they've got airports, they've got airlines.
Yes.
So it is so important that they can be right there, right by the school. So we're really encouraging our regional areas. Shout out to Shepparton and Bendigo in particular, where we really want to capture and engage.
Love it. Fist pump. Love everything about that. Annie, thank you. Keep us updated with how you go.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Rochelle.
See ya. Annie Daly, the Chief Executive of Aviation Aerospace Australia. If you want your school to get involved, jump on board and apply. It doesn't matter where you are. Judy's in Golden Valley. Hi, Judy.
Hi. How are you, Rochelle?
I'm really good. What did you want to say?
When I was in year 12, I had three careers that I really couldn't choose between. And when I mentioned to the careers advisor that the first two were geology and archaeology, I was told that as a female, I wouldn't be allowed on site. I would be stuck in the back room of a museum cataloguing specimens.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Which wasn't so, very... So what did you do then, Judy? Did you go into that field? Did you say, "Well, bugger you, no. I'll show you," or did you...
Well, my other choice, and it wasn't really the third choice, was I went and did Div 1 nursing, which was a wonderful career for 37 years. But I was able to have geology as sort of as a hobby. And, you know, I joined a gym club and...
Oh, so you found a way for it to get into your life.
Yeah.
Do you, you know, earlier there was a text, I think it was Lou, that said, "I still have the what ifs." Like, do you do you still think sometimes, well, what if I did do this professionally?
Yes, occasionally. And this year we're going to go up to Winton, you know, to go on the dinosaur trail. I'm still very interested. And we, you know, we grew up near a beach and I did find some, you know, fossils and things around there, only small, insignificant ones. But I've got quite a collection, a geology collection, and I do think sometimes, yeah, I wonder what it would have been like if I had done it.
I love the idea, though, Judy, that you found a way to keep it in your life. Thank you. Gosh, it's quite full on, isn't it? And thinking back to what you were told and you just go, yeah, okay, all right, and you know, you try and do the right thing. Lots of texts still coming in about the funding cut to Writers Victoria. This Writers Vic will be greatly missed if its grants are withdrawn. It's a hub for so many aspiring writers, offering classes and workshops and information on all things, competitions and so much more, just adding to my voice to the others that you've had and hopefully received. And thank you for interviewing Tony Jordan. I know, wasn't she wonderful? Mark Smith has called through from Anglesey. Mark, good morning.
Hey, Rochelle, how are you going?
Really well. Now, you're an author yourself.
I am. And look, I just wanted to make the point, thanks for bringing up the discussion on Writers Victoria. I just wanted to make the point that people come to writing at all different stages of their life, and not everybody has the opportunity to go to university to study writing. And it's where Writers Victoria does such a fantastic job. I wasn't published until I was in my 50s and now have five books out.
Because you publish and write young adult fiction, yeah?
That's right, yeah. And now I've moved into adult fiction as well. And I said, actually, Tony Jordan, who you spoke to earlier, was one of my early mentors and teachers at Writers Victoria.
Oh, my goodness.
So it fills a gap. It fills a gap for writers that is not covered by unis or the, you know, as I said, not everyone has the opportunity to go to university to study writing.
Absolutely.
I'm also really pleased to hear your earlier caller from the Moorabool Writers Group, because regional writers in Victoria have been so well supported by Writers Victoria. There's a group down on the Surf Coast that was set up nearly 10 years ago and is still going now with the support of Writers Victoria. So it's not just Melbourne-based. It crosses, you know, it offers courses online and in person for people all around the state.
So what do we do, Mark? Because often these funding cuts just kind of happen and nobody really knows about them until we start talking about them and we realise the significance and the importance and the role that they play. We hang our hats on how creative we are in this state. But if you take those opportunities away, all of a sudden it's only the privileged, as you say, and those who have enough money that can study and that could be connected. And you don't want this to be about who you network with. Or, I mean, I know that networking is important, but something like these groups is how you network if you don't know anyone.
That's exactly right. And I can only say that, I mean, pressure needs to be brought on. I think this is a terrible decision, obviously. And pressure needs to be brought through your local member, through, you know, I'm sure submission processes through Writers Victoria as well, because I know that there's short-term funding that's in place at the moment, but that's not going to last. I think it would just be, as we say, we're supposed to be a city of literature. And how can we be that if we're taking away, you know, those elemental parts of our culture?
Mark, thank you so much for calling through. I really appreciate it.
That's a pleasure. Thanks, Rochelle.
That's author Mark Smith is called through, reacting to the funding cut of Writers Victoria. Sue's called through on this as well. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Rochelle. Listen, talking about putting pressure on a Labor government, I'm hoping that the Victorian branches of the Australian Writers Guild and also our union, the MEAA, Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance, I hope that they are engaged in lobbying our government. I think that would
be... Well, there's a lot of signatures. I think it's about 2,000 signatures at the moment. Whether or not there are guilds and groups on board with that, I'm not sure. How does this impact you, Sue?
Oh, look, I've been involved in the arts forever, and particularly the screen industry, and the need for Victorian stories to be told is fundamental to everything that we do in the rest of the entertainment and arts industry. It's fundamental. So I just think the unions need to get on board and lobby our own government, basically.
Give some money back.
Yeah, and by the way, I didn't have a crappy careers counsellor at McRobertson Girls High School.
Yeah.
I never had to take any advice from them.
Oh, I know. I think everyone now is thinking back to what they'd said to their careers counsellor and what they were told. Sue, thank you. Well, if you were paying any attention to the Grammys, if you watched the news last night, you would have heard about a musician called Bad Bunny. You may have heard a little bit of his acceptance speech at the Grammys.
Before I say thanks to God, I'm going to say eyes out. We're not savage, we're not animals, we're not aliens, we are humans and we are Americans.
So who is Bad Bunny? This is a little bit of what he sounds like.
Muchas novias, hoy tengo a una, mañana otra, ey. Pero no hay boda, Titi me preguntó si tengo muchas novias.
So not only did he take out huge awards at the Grammys, he is set to play the Super Bowl, and there are even rumours... Probably not true, but the rumours were floating around that he is the reason why President Donald Trump wasn't going to attend the Super Bowl. So what makes him so controversial and what makes him so loved at the moment? Dan Condon, music editor at Double J. Dan, look, I have to admit, I didn't really know anything about Bad Bunny and I'm learning a lot about him in the last 24 hours. Is he that controversial? Like, where did the rumours even start that this is the reason why President Donald Trump wasn't going to go to the Super Bowl because he was playing?
I don't think controversial is a word that I would use to describe Bad Bunny at all, to be honest with you. I think if singing in a language other than English is controversial, then I think we need to have a good hard look at ourselves. Look, okay, he is a little bit of a something of a political figure in that he stands up for people who, or for immigrants, let's be honest. That is, you know, something that he knows that a big part of his fan base, yeah. And especially his American fan base, were probably not born in the US. Some of them may not be documented citizens of the United States.
Well, he said that, hasn't he? And he said that he's been worried about his shows and where he plays, that some of his fans will get arrested.
We're talking about the biggest artist in the world right now, and before anyone calls in, Taylor Swift is off market at the moment. She's busy doing other things, so don't get angry at me. Bad Bunny is bigger right now. And
the Swifties will come after you, Dan.
No, and I think that it's actually really important to acknowledge that the scale of his popularity, it is really, he is that big. Now, for him to put out his biggest album yet, which won Album of the Year yesterday at the Grammys, and to do a full world tour with zero dates in the United States, that is definitely sending a message. And he said in an interview, look, I've got to be honest with you, I don't want ICE agents coming to my gig and dragging out people from my audience when they're trying to enjoy my show. So, look, I don't necessarily think that's controversial, but I do think that it's a unique position that we find
and
ourselves in.
And it's brave on so many levels too. Like, and the financial hit that he would take to not play in some areas. And it wasn't just him. There were so many artists that spoke from the heart at the Grammys yesterday about the current state of the United States and how immigrants feel at the moment and the role that music and musicians do play in not just having a political voice, but in our creative lives.
Look, absolutely. And I think that we do rely on musicians and artists more broadly to say this kind of stuff and to stand up. I actually was surprised at how few artists used their platform when making speeches to talk about this issue that's going on at the moment. Obviously, Billie Eilish made a very strong statement. Bad Bunny did as well. The rest seemed a little more careful. I guess you have to be careful if you want to sell records in this current environment. Speaking on money, I mean, that's a big thing that Bad Bunny did do when he put out this album is he said, okay, all of the first gigs, the first kind of dozen or so are all happening in Puerto Rico. He is a Puerto Rican man. And if you want to come to Puerto Rico and you're American, you're more than welcome because we are actually part of America. You can come. You don't need a passport or a visa. And the I don't actually have the figures in front of me, but as a result of these shows, the it was a huge injection into the Puerto Rican economy. I think it was in the hundreds of millions of dollars, but I'd have to check that. But it was an enormous amount of money, and it really kind of exhibits his passion for his country and for his people.
And he's coming here, isn't there? There's a text from Paul saying that my son, who's 19, is going to one of his Sydney concerts.
Yeah, he's playing in Sydney. Those tickets sold out very, very quickly. He's doing a couple of shows. And look, that's incredibly frustrating for those of us who don't live in Sydney, but I think it will be an incredible celebration of all fans of Bad Bunny. But I've been talking to a few people in the Latino community in Sydney who say, like, this is one of the biggest things that's ever happened, having him in the country. You really cannot understate the importance of this artist, not just generally in pop, but particularly for Latino people from the Puerto Rican diaspora. He is just such an important figure. He sings in language. He brings in elements of their traditional music. It's the kind of music that what you played before was very new, modern, very current, but he does also have songs that really appeal to the elder generation as well.
Great, love it. I've learnt so much today. Dan, thank you. Can you remember what you told your careers counsellor you wanted to be, Dan, when you went to see your careers counsellor?
I hate this question because I can only answer it honestly, and the honest truth is journalist.
Oh, okay.
I was a little kid.
Oh, good on you, mate. Thank you, Dan Condon, music editor at Double J. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon.